Hello, dear listener. It is Jazza here again from the Right Dishonourable podcast. You can still... I'm interrupting your usual programming again just to tell you that you can still vote for us on the British Podcast Awards. At least I think so. And also, at the tail end of this week's episode, we once again dive into listener engagement. It wouldn't be a Right Dishonourable podcast if I didn't bugger up something technically, and Jimmy is particularly quiet in the final segment, but I still think it's worth listening to. Anyway, let's get on with the show.
Hello and welcome to episode 75 of the Right Dishonourable podcast. My name's Jimmy, and as per usual, I'm joined by Jazza John. Jazza, how are you?
Good.
Yeah, happy that I did the spiel in the usual way.
In all of the, yeah, you're like clockwork.
Very on point.
Thank you. Yeah, you can call yourself on point. I just wanna don't toot your own trumpet.
Okay. joining us this week is Hussein Kesvani, who, among other things, used to write for BuzzFeed and occasionally writes for Vice still. Mm. Why don't you start by telling people what it is you're doing and what it is you're all about politically, I guess.
I wish I knew what I was doing.
Okay.
It's probably like the answer. I'm doing like a lot of different things at the moment. So yeah, I'm currently writing a column at Vice about technology and the internet. And that's like one thing I'm interested in. My big project right now, I'm working on a book about religion and the internet and how the internet is kind of undermining traditional religious institutions. And I kind of freelance at various places doing consulting work, basically around the topics of like technology. Mm. In terms of where I am politically, that's a really good question. That changes everything. I would ultimately like, I would call
before
myself
before like, all of the, everything like hit the fan and like sprayed shit everywhere.
Yeah.
Where were you? You're like pre-2015. I was back when life was normal.
I really liked Ed Miliband. I was a Miliband laborer.
A Milifandom.
I was a Milifandom, nice centrist with like soft liberal lefty tendencies. Mm. And then
and now you're
I
think, a Trump voter now, right?
Yes, and now I'm a fascist. No, I would say that I'm a democratic socialist. That's probably like the best description. Mm. But
that party no longer exists, unfortunately.
Yeah. It's not particularly helpful in the bigger scheme of things.
You also have the podcast No Country for
Men. Oh yeah,
Men
I'm a podcaster. Does that count as a job?
No. as people who have a weekly podcast, no, in no way, shape, or form does it count as a job.
So I'm a podcast producer. Mm-hmm. My friend Rohan Banerjee, who works at the New Statesman, and I started a podcast in November last year. Basically about race and culture and being a Asian person in Britain.
It's very good. You should listen to it.
You also have some involvement with Theos, the think tank.
Yeah, so that's where I do consultancy work every so often. So
we think that you're selling yourself short.
Yeah,
you're just adding things to your digital CV now.
Thank you. I just don't want to be rambling on about like you know all the stuff I do to like compensate for the fact that I don't have friends.
Oh dear.
Well, we've invited you in for coffee today. So
thank you. It's great coffee as well. Thank you so much.
No answer. If you've been listening regularly, then you'll know that we talk about three topics each week about politics, social issues, current events, that kind of shit. Mm. What are we going to talk about, Jimmy? Because my mind just went blank.
That's usually my job for my mind to go blank. So we're going to start off and talk about the most obvious thing, which was the attack in Westminster that's being treated as a terrorist incident at the moment, although a lot of the details are kind of coming in literally as we talk and things are clearing up. But we're just going to be discussing that in the round, I guess. Mm-hmm. And just because, you know, it's the biggest news topic on Fleet Street at this point.
And we're definitely Fleet Street.
Well, we just follow the news agenda.
In an apartment in Stratford.
Yeah. Well, even Fleet Street isn't Fleet Street. They don't actually work there anymore.
Nobody's actually there. Yeah, it's just tourist attractions.
So second up is the...
Les élections françaises.
So what's been happening in les élections françaises?
C'est très bon baguette. I don't know what I'm doing. I actually do speak French. But the five main candidates for the French elections had a really long and boring debate earlier this week. There are two main frontrunners, one being Marine Le Pen, who is from the Front National, And Jimmy will be calling them the National Front because he hates you saying foreign things.
You do sound like a dick sometimes, especially when it's just unnecessary.
No, I'm just like, all of the Chinese cities are pronounced Beijing, Nanjing. Yeah, like, I'm totally down for
you do. You're a bit of a tryhard when it comes to foreign languages.
Yeah, but that's because I'm a global metropolitan elite.
That is true.
But she had a face-off. That's not what it's called, is it? That's a movie with John Travolta. A standoff.
A fracker.
A fracker. A bit of a kerfuffle with Emmanuel Macron, who is interestingly not from either the Socialist Party or the centre-right party, Les Républicains.
The Republicans, in English.
Les Républicains. So we have two people who are seen as kind of like not party insiders
used to be a socialist. He's part of the Socialist Party.
He was a member of the Socialist Party, but is generally seen as a centrist. But we'll talk about that going forward. The BBC decided to, for clicks, say that they talked about the burkini. They spoke about the burkini for about 3 minutes in a 3-hour debate.
Did you watch the entire thing in French?
I watched the first hour in French and then started to watch Stranger Things instead because it's more entertaining. Like, it was really boring. I just did like opening statements, closing statements, tried to find the bikini bit, done, sorted.
Efficient.
Yeah, I know, right?
And the third topic has also been foisted upon us by you, so maybe you should outline that.
Listener, basically, if anything doesn't revolve around UK politics or US politics, and it sounds a bit wanky or internet-y, it's probably me who suggested it. But YouTube got in a bit of Barney at the end of last week, where a load of LGBT creators discovered that their videos were being blocked in a type of YouTube called restricted mode, which is often used by it's promoted for families who want to protect their children from certain types of content, and public institutions, libraries, schools, that kind of thing, and it turned out that a lot of LGBT content was being blocked purely for the fact that it was LGBT, regardless of sexual suggestion in the content or swearing or violence or any of that kind of stuff. YouTube, for once, have actually been quite quick at saying, soz, we screwed up, we're going to fix it. I, along with a load of other creators, of course it was me, because I'm that guy, have a petition that's asking for specific things from YouTube as well. There you go.
There you go.
Wow.
Okay, so now we're going to do the slightly awkward segue of moving back to Westminster. So I'm assuming that you followed the Westminster attacks as they were going on sort of live on social media. What was your reaction?
Yeah, so I was on a train back from Stoke, and it was sort of weird because I work, Theos is based in Westminster, it's about 2 minutes away from Parliament, and that whole place was on lockdown, so it was sort of interesting talking to my colleagues who were like, yeah, we're watching stuff that's happening outside our window on Twitter and just trying to figure out what's going on. And it was also very surreal kind of watching it while on a train from Stoke, because we all found out when the train driver was just like, yeah, we're heading into London, the traffic's okay, by the way, a terrorist attack has happened. I repeat, but that doesn't mean you can't enjoy London, but just remember, a terrorist attack has happened.
Did you use that phrase? That
yeah,
oh,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah, I'm not joking. And it was just like the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
And you know, like, it's like a new iteration of the chirpy train announcer, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, so I wrote a piece about this on Medium when I got back, but it was really about the predictability of like what was going to happen. And you can kind of map it out on social media, which is have the news thing that happens when you have lots and lots of people who are retweeting it, lots of people who are retweeting it in good meaning ways. Then at some point, like 10, 15 minutes later, you have the hashtags. You know, you have the right wing people kind of saying, oh, I bet it's a Muslim. And it turns into this whole ridiculous game. And what I said was that, like, the whole like speculation becomes gamified because we're all just playing this game of like, what race is the attacker? Is the attacker Muslim? And like, there's one side that really hopes he isn't, and there's one side that really, really hopes he does. And it's like turned into this really cynical reaction of like, who can get the most retweets? And then it suddenly descends into like retweeting like really badly made anti-Islam memes and, you know, doing,
and then
know,
even
solidarity,
like on
hashtags.
Even on closed networks like Facebook,
yeah,
people almost react now as if they are a head of state and express their condolences and say that they're thinking of the victims. And I'm like, mate, you live in Stoke. What are you, like...
Hey. No, I mean, this was a question that we were kind of talking about in the office. We're like, should we put out a statement just saying that we kind of hope that people are okay? And we sort of realised that.
I feel like a public institution should.
But we're not. We're a private organisation, and we decided not to on the basis that we felt that it wasn't in our duty to do so while there was an ongoing police thing that took place. And I think that was a good call to make. But it is a thing where, like, now social media kind of allows you to kind of make your own opinion about, like, something that's happened, and in some ways kind of compels us to do so, especially if you work in media, but just, like, anyone who kind of operates in that space. Mm-hmm. What I can say, like, I didn't tweet during the period when it was happening. I was reading a lot, but, like, the compulsion to say something, the compulsion to kind of make some type of statement was very, very strong, and I think a lot of people act on that impulse. And I sort of wonder whether it's just because... it's a coping mechanism, or people want to feel part of something.
Yeah, I think that that's a big part of it.
I don't know, like, how old you guys were when the 2005 attacks happened.
Mm-hmm, the 7/7 bombings.
Yeah, this was like before the age of like social media, and I didn't hear about these attacks until like I came out of school at like 4 o'clock.
Oh, we heard about it in, so because I grew up in like the commuter belt, like all of the kids who went to my school, all of their dads worked in London. And so we were like pulled out of school.
Right, okay.
And told to be picked up and go home.
I was actually at home, so I just picked it up on the TV news. But otherwise I can imagine I wouldn't have heard about it until later.
But I would imagine like the reaction that people had was very different, right? And maybe that's because that was the first time something like that had really happened on UK soil. But also because we didn't really have these machines that allowed us to make these takes.
So I would challenge that it's the first time that it's happened on UK soil, because I think there's just a pragmatism to the way that London specifically has kind of dealt with terrorist attacks.
Because we've dealt with them with the IRA, especially
the 80s. And... the hysteria that kind of surrounds a lot of other terrorist attacks doesn't, maybe I'm wrong, but it doesn't feel like it comes through so much when it's London, at least with the two major incidents that
I think it depends on your particular filter bubble on social media. Because the right wing things, I'm sure they were going on. I can readily imagine that. And I did pick up a little bit of that on Reddit, but my Twitter feed, and I'm not necessarily patched in purely to social justice warriors or anything, but it seemed relatively sober from my point of view, but then I wasn't going looking for the crazies, as it goes.
So my Twitter is largely filled up with journalists, which means that you just end up having like lots of the same information retweeted over and over, and then the whole like don't post pictures of like atrocities and stuff like that. It's very kind of cautious and not necessarily ideological.
Now, which is something new. I think that that's actually a really interesting and important change in the way that social media has reacted to these things, because I still haven't seen the face of the attacker yet.
Yeah, I don't think...
Did you see the picture of him being wheeled off in the ambulance kind of carriage?
Yes.
Yeah.
But so technically, still not seen his face.
Okay.
Yeah, so enough. I mean, so eventually it takes a while to get back, and it also depends on how much time you spend, it depends on where you go. I think for, like, look, for people who are interested in like the whole like right-wing social space, you'll always like kind of go towards those places. I mean, because I kind of do this as part of my job, like I was looking at like the right-wing verticals, and it was literally exactly what you expected.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So like the first thing that was posted was the Daily Mail using an eyewitness account to kind of say this Asian man with like an 8-inch long knife.
Right.
And that was the first thing that was spread around. Then it was a small rumour about a white convert. And then the picture kind of came out, and they were like, okay, this is probably likely the guy. Mm-hmm. So they were like, their conversation was very different because it was literally about identifying, and it was literally about, we know who this is and we know why they did it. We're just trying to like prove it so that we can kind of reinforce our points. Mm-hmm. The liberals were like that too. They were kind of, their thing was very much, they were also just like, yeah, it's probably a Muslim, but it doesn't mean it's all Muslims. It doesn't mean it's all Islam. Yeah. And keep reinforcing that point.
So people start spinning before even information.
Yeah, social media, I kind of said this in my piece. It's like, we hold on to our positions, and the thing about social media isn't that it's necessarily a power. It doesn't necessarily give you the power to change your opinions. In fact, it's more likely that it will reinforce the opinions that you have.
It's kind of been interesting to find out. So your reasons for saying, like, we didn't really know enough and people jumped to conclusions was why it was very deliberately off of social media in the aftermath of it. And I think that's one of the reasons why I didn't really kind of get hit by a truck in the same way that other terrorist attacks have, like, elicited an emotional response from me. We found out that he is a Muslim convert, has a history of being in and out of prisons.
But not really for terrorist-related offences as such.
But there was speculation on the Today programme this morning that was possibly where radicalisation happened. He also taught in Saudi Arabia for a period. Do you think that there's... And also, most interestingly, actually, I think, is that he's 52.
Yeah.
And there's kind of like a stereotype of it being the young, disillusioned kid who is angry at the world and then turns to extremism. Do you think that there's anything vaguely significant about his slightly different profile and also how lo-fi his attack was?
So, yes and no. I'm worried about, like, so when I used to cover Muslim news at BuzzFeed, it was a big question about, everything was always about networks, and it was always about what are the associations that can be made. And that's the way that the media still kind of do it, right? So, like, every type of big study that comes out of King's College or comes out of, like, you know, Georgetown or whatever, they all look at networks, and they all look at, like, you know, this is where they're influenced from and stuff like that. Partially that's true, but then we're all kind of networked because no one's really isolated anymore. If you have a social media account, then, you know, you all have networks. If I, like, committed a robbery right now, right, they would say, well, beforehand, he was hanging out with, you know, two guys in Stratford. And one of them had, like, a very Islamically looking beard.
It is ginger.
So what happened during that hour in Stratford? I think it's easy to make assumptions based on social media networks and stuff and kind of remove the fact that individuals do have their own agency. And we kind of allow that when, you know, when we're looking at other crimes, like, we kind of allow the fact that individuals make their own choices, and we should really be looking at that individual rather than, like, the network that was built around it, right? But then at the same time, you know, if the reports are true that he did swear allegiance to Islamic State, then yes, networks are important. It also means that, like, this isn't...
Islamic State have claimed fucking everything.
Yeah.
Well, like, somebody's tripped down the stairs, Islamic State.
Actually, this journalist from New York Magazine was saying that most of the stuff... Pretty much all the stuff Islamic State.
Is that Rukmini?
Possibly.
Yeah, so she's, like, the person that I go to, and most people
She was saying the stuff that Islamic State claim, it's usually them. Like, they're actually quite reliable in that sense.
So, but by them claiming it, does it mean that we've had contact with this person at some point? Because if you are somebody who is looking to those kinds of networks, then you're probably going to get in contact with... IS, ISIS, Daesh, blah.
I mean, I'm not really clear on how.
But have they coordinated it? No. But is that how terrorism exists now?
And this is the big question. And I don't think journalists really have spent a lot of time trying to figure. Well, besides, like, people like Rukmini, who, like, have the time to do that type of stuff.
Oh, and you, of course.
No, not even me.
I wish
I had the time. Like, it's now. Like, now that I'm not kind of a full time journalist, like, it's actually nicer to, like, look at those things and look at it more in depth. You know, the thing about supposedly joining IS is that it's super easy to do it. You literally just have to say, okay, I'm swearing allegiance to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi live on the Right to Honorable podcast. And there you go.
We'll see if this gets picked up. Exciting.
Like, it's super easy to do that. Does that mean that, like, it's significant? Maybe, maybe not. I don't think speculation is necessarily the best answer, and I do think that if we're going to look at this properly over the next few days, we do need to be looking at, like, what were the choices that this individual made that led to this point? What was this guy's history? Who were the people that he was hanging out with? Were they influential to him? But ultimately, like, is this man sane enough to, like, for us to kind of say, okay, like, we need to treat this as an individual case? So I think it's, like, important not to speculate too much on that.
Amber Rudd, who I always forget is the Home Secretary.
She's very forgettable.
I just keep on assuming.
No offense to her, but
I keep on assuming that it's still Theresa May. I'm like, no, she is the Prime Minister.
Maybe she's doing both.
There have been reports that Theresa May is kind of still running the Home Office. And everything else.
But Amber Rudd, the official Home Office response to this, and obviously she's in charge of like domestic security, and so this comes under her remit. She said that she basically put it like one person got through. This is one of the ones that got through. And this comes only like a few weeks after I think the Home Office said that they'd stopped 13 attacks or something the past 2 years.
Mm.
Something along those lines, something nice and vague. Do you think that these kinds of attacks, even if they are happening very rarely in the UK, and it is incredibly rarely that these things happen, the last big one was 7/7, unless I'm pulling a complete blank, which was
The Rigby thing, when Lee Rigby was killed, can be counted.
But these, like, you're still going to be more likely to be killed by a car crossing the road than an Islamic terrorist.
I think it should be treated just as like a very minor crime problem, effectively. I know obviously the dynamics are different from the way the security forces handle it, but just in terms of how Britain psychologically interprets these attacks, I don't think it should be seen as, oh, this is a massive deal, because the damaging thing about terrorism is really the psychological impact.
Yeah.
It isn't, you know, not in a callous way, but it's a relatively small people who are directly affected or injured or killed in these kind of attacks. It's the wider impact. And so if you just say, well, this is a thing that happens, it's now a risk that you have to accept if you live in a place like London, and just go about your day, the best response.
They kind of went all out on Sadiq Khan, didn't they? Because of the statement
Donald Trump Jr. criticised him for saying basically what I've just said.
A man who can sit very well.
That's a reference to some photos that
to one of my favourite memes of this year, of him sitting on a rock.
Weirdly.
In a very strange way.
Yeah.
But like Sadiq Khan said, like, so him and a bunch of like right wing trolls and, you know, the people following him were like, oh, Sadiq Khan is like saying that we just have to accept terrorism. It's like, no, he didn't. But like what he said is actually genuinely true, which is that, you are at risk. You are at a higher risk if you live in a big city, because there are more people there, right? And because there are more, you know, people live in different conditions. And, you know, there's never been, actually, no, that, you know, all the BBC crime dramas are set in like really rural towns, aren't they?
It's because they have a remit.
I'm just thinking about like all the Marvel stuff on Netflix and how everything's like set in New York. It's like, no, they're not going to like
set a large amount of it set in London now and at fake tube stations. I'm mainly thinking of Thor. Quite a lot of that happened in Greenwich.
And it's just like, you know, if you live in a big city, you're going to be more at risk, right? But you're going to be more at risk from everyone. And if you're going to even look at it from a London perspective, right? It's like, you're going to be more at risk of, like, getting mugged in London than you are going to be in, like, a rural town in Ramsgate.
Mm.
You know, that's not a controversial statement to make. And yet, somehow it was.
So, Jazza, French elections, they're happening.
Isn't it exciting? We might have another fascist wave happening in the Western world.
I mean, the polls seem to indicate that Marine Le Pen, who is the aforementioned fascist,
She's managed to rebrand the Front National
quite effectively.
So she
probably won't win ultimately.
Well,
so
basically, how the French elections work is she will be running off against like loads of candidates from lots of different political parties. The main people that she's running against are Jean-Luc Mélenchon, Benoît Hamon, Emmanuel Macron and François Fillon. She is currently in the first round of voting pretty much neck and neck, had about 25% each with Emmanuel Macron, who is a socialist who's kind of pitching himself as a centrist candidate, basically as an independent. And then she will probably go into a runoff head-to-head with him in the second round of voting, which is a couple of months later. And we've seen this before. Jacques Chirac had a runoff with her dad in the final round of electoral voting in France.
That was back in the 90s, right?
No, it was early 2000s.
Okay.
And he got absolutely destroyed by Chirac. Chirac got like 85% of the vote. Marine Le Pen has been really, really good at branding herself as just like a populist nationalist rather than a Nazi sympathizer racist, which is what her dad was. Marine Le Pen has been really good at mobilising the youth vote. Youth unemployment in France is still incredibly high. Unemployment in France is twice that of the UK, for example. It's at about 10.5%. Youth unemployment is about 1 in 5. She's managed to whip up quite a lot of concern about the Muslim population in France that is seen as not integrating, that is seen as anti-gay rights, anti-women's rights. There's obviously the burkini ban, which is a ridiculous name for anything. I am skeptical as to how easily it's going to go for Emmanuel Macron if he does indeed go through to the second round to face off against her. But this whole election cycle has been an absolute shit show. François Hollande, who's the current president, has such low approval ratings. He's the first French president in history not to seek in a second term. We had François Fillon, who is the Republican candidate, who is getting all caught up in the fact that he was giving his wife like millions of euros of cash. He used to be the front runner, and now he's kind of gone belly up.
Well, he's accused of corruption.
Yeah, he's accused. It's been brilliant. The French people using like English terms is hilarious. It's called Penelope Gate because his wife is called Penelope.
She's actually Welsh.
And she's Welsh.
Yeah.
Who knows? The Welsh making waves internationally. But I genuinely am pretty, because like I watched the debate earlier this week, and it was really fucking long. But also, Marine Le Pen is fascinating because we've heard it all before. She is a lot more like Farage than she is like Trump. A lot of Americans will draw similarities between her and Trump. She's a lot more of
much more sophisticated than
much
Trump.
Much more sophisticated. And it's lots of like... So, for example, in this debate, she didn't once talk about the fact that she wants a referendum on France's membership of the European Union. She didn't... They managed to avoid actually talking about Europe at all, which is just crazy. And she managed to make the debate about prosperity, about security, and about liberté, and the French love a bit of liberté. Mm.
So, Hussein, what's your view on all of this?
I don't really know a lot about France other than what my friend and French journalist Nabila Ramdani said to me the other day.
Do you recount?
So she doesn't think Marine Le Pen's going to win. She thinks that actually she's going to be much more disappointing than we expect. And the reason why is because Marine Le Pen is... So what she says is that French politics is still very much traditional and archaic. So they still kind of value certain people, which is why French politics has been filled with like nepotism and scandal and stuff like that. It's because the French political system is very much still about aesthetics, and Marine Le Pen is more like a Donald Trump figure than she is a who's that French? Who's like the really big French political titan that
Nicolas Sarkozy?
No.
Jacques Chirac?
No. I'll remember it at some point.
Charles de Gaulle.
Let's go.
Any of the French ones.
She's more
aesthetics, yeah. What do you mean?
As
by
in
that?
Like they like the way that politics looks outwards, right? So I remember watching this BBC documentary about Sarkozy and how like, you know, the French still kind of want their leaders to be reminiscent of like princes. I don't know whether that's true. But they kind of believe in like the grandeur, and it's kind of like, you know, would they really want to give the Elysee Palace to Marine Le Pen? Is like the big question.
So there's, right? there's a level of dignity afforded to the president that you wouldn't necessarily get with the UK Prime Minister.
Yeah. So it's more like the idea like, yeah, the Front National might be more successful in the elections generally, but will they get the presidency?
So they've got some regional seats, right? And some
and Marine Le Pen represents northwestern France, I think, in the European Parliament. What's I think quite interesting, and what like mirroring what Hussein was saying about the kind of like old-fashionedness of French politics, is how important left and right still is in in France.
That's actually where the concept of left and right originates.
So you still have, like every time that you see a summary of all of the candidates, or the five main candidates who are currently running, they will almost always be placed very neatly on a spectrum from left to right, and then quite literally with their position left to right. You still have the two big beasts are the Les Républicains and the Socialists.
So they're centre-right and centre-left, respectively.
Yeah, and France does have a history of breakaway parties, like En Marche, which is Emmanuel Macron's kind of break-off party from the Socialists. What I worry about, and it was what your friend was saying, was the fact that I think that this is exactly why Marine Le Pen, if she's ever going to win, it's probably going to be now, because of the disaffection with the idea of French politics. Mm. They all went to the same school, they all scratch each other's backs, they employ their own wives, they're in the pockets of the banks. And the only two people, the left is dead in this election, the Socialists and Mélenchon, who is basically the Communist Party candidate, but is running independently because communism still has a bit of a bad taste in French people's mouths. Although not so much as in the UK and the US. The left is basically dead. And the two people who could run off against Marine Le Pen, François Fillon and Emmanuel Macron, are seen as corrupt for giving their family members jobs in Fillon's case, and being basically a Hillary Clinton, a shill of the banks in the case of Macron.
So he used to work as a banker, didn't he?
Yes. Macron has also never held an elective office. He was a economics minister under François Hollande, who's the current president, but has never actually been elected to a position. Mm. But François Fillon has been a representative since his 20s and is now in his 60s, I believe. So those two people, the only chance of beating Marine Le Pen, who, despite being like a powerful individual speaker and like somebody who's been in the European Parliament for years, she very much looks like an insurgent, like somebody who's going to fuck shit up. Mm. And people right now want to fuck shit up. Because of the high levels of unemployment, because of fear of immigration, because of shit.
There's a sense I have, though, and you can look at the Dutch election as a representative of this, is that there's a certain saturation level for kind of right-wing populist parties. Mm-hmm. And even though people, like last year, were talking about the sweep of UKIP and Geert Wilders' party in the Netherlands, and also Marine Le Pen and the National Front in France, and I guess even alternative for Deutschland in Germany, it hasn't really sort of surged in such a way that these people could actually ever form government. I mean, when people were talking about the Dutch elections in you know, apocalyptic terms, it's like all of the other Dutch parties had said that they weren't willing to work with Wilders. Mm-hmm. And so he was never going to get anywhere near government. And there just seems to be a certain level that these parties can get to, which is sometimes about a quarter of the electorate, which is still a fair chunk. But if they can't get beyond that, usually the various electoral systems block them out.
I mean, there was also the case in the UK, like UKIP would never get a poll anything over like 20%.
Yeah.
And in a popular vote system, so Trump managed to get in partially because of a flawed electoral college, where he actually lost the popular vote but still became president. This doesn't exist in France. In France, it's done purely by popular vote. And so Marine Le Pen would literally have to get more votes than Macron, so there's not that loophole for her there. I would still be sceptical, because it depends also. Macron is incredibly young. He's in his 30s. There is kind of like the respect for the presidency, the gravitas that somebody needs to have. And in that, in the debate that happened last week, it was like Marine Le Pen was the person who kind of wiped the floor with everybody. Mm. Macron failed to make any kind of like headway, really, looked inexperienced.
Does Le Pen have the same level of toxicity as Trump in the US or Nigel Farage in the UK?
To a certain extent. But she is... still She's seen as the reformer of the Front National, and has deliberately like kicked out her own father, who is the Holocaust denying racist, and made it more palatable. And so it is a lot easier to vote for somebody like her than it is for her predecessors in the Front National.
Sure, but I mean, you can make a shit sandwich taste better. It's still a shit sandwich at the end of the day. You know, she's starting from a low base on a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, very true.
It's also kind of whether they will trust other people in the National Front, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
And so much of this is kind of hinged on that. Like, it's also why UKIP, I think, fails to kind of really break through, because it's like you can be compelled by Nigel Farage, but when you kind of realise that, when you kind of don't have that same compulsion for his followers, who aren't as charismatic and aren't as careful with their words, and that's a really low bar.
Mm-hmm.
And in France, it's very much like that. You could see that in the Netherlands too, right? Like, you know, Wilders did less well than expected.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't do horribly in terms of, you know,
they were still the second most votes.
Yeah,
for any party.
And they kind of, and they built
joint
on,
second, I believe.
Okay. And they built on their votes. So I think that'll be the same. Like, the National Front will build on their votes for the French election.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that she'll reach the presidency. Now, the real risk is, so I reckon that Fillon's going to win it.
Fillon.
So Fillon, well, I don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. I don't think he'll get to the second round.
Okay.
I think Macron is is more.
He's
likely.
Also the sexiest one, which is obviously.
So great. I think
we know how I feel about sexy politicians.
I think Macron versus Le Pen is going to be very dangerous.
Uh-huh.
Because I sort of wonder whether, because Macron's going to be like that, will have to be like the be all character for like everyone on the left, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
So he can't isolate the centrist leftists, but at the same time he can't isolate the socialist leftists and like, you know, and the progressives. Le Pen doesn't really have to do so much because conservatism is like at this stage is like fairly easy,
mm-hmm.
because the conservatism isn't about arguing for free market. She's not doing that. She's not arguing, you know, she's arguing for protectionism. So she's taken away a lot of like the standard left economic argument. So all she needs to really do is ram home the anti-Islam, anti-refugee messages, which has been proven to work. Macron has to do a lot more. And I guess with Fillon, like, if we're looking for an anti-Le Pen candidate, then he's better off because the conservative premise is already there. So it'll be literally just about saying, okay, you have this stupid idea, but it's not going to work. I am going to put restrictions on Muslim women this way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Macron can really do that.
I'm more scared of a Fillon-Le Pen runoff than
really?
I am about a Macron-Le Pen runoff, because Fillon is so personally damaged by the nepotism,
scandal.
By the scandal.
So
but like,
he represents a Clinton versus Trump thing. Almost.
Yeah, I mean, like, he represents everything.
Yeah, but historically, like, you know, the French
Le
haven't
Le
really cared that much about. They've kind of expected that their political system is going to be like riddled with scandal, right?
There's an element of that.
Americans like to believe that they have like perfection.
Mm-hmm. I mean, all like it's almost wonderful because every single one of the main five candidates at the moment has got some kind of scandal surrounding them. Be it like they married their old English teacher, or they are racist. Like, there's a wonderful broad spectrum. I just think so. I'm going to make a video tomorrow about why I think Marine Le Pen is going to win. I also don't think she's actually going to win.
Yeah,
spoiler alert.
You're just here for content.
Yeah, exactly. It's all about the clickbait. But I think that perhaps the rise of populism kind of hit a speed bump post Brexit after the like near win of the far right, basically Nazi Party in Austria. After the defeat of Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, and I think the defeat of Marine Le Pen later on this year in France, I think there's going to be a bit of a stall. But then, does that mean that it's just going to end up flaring up again in another election cycle?
I think people will read it in that way, but it's worth pointing out that all of these different countries have their own unique political circumstances,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of it is just pure timing. I mean, it's possible that the Dutch election could have taken place before a Brexit vote,
yeah.
you know, if things had been scheduled slightly differently. So I wouldn't see it necessarily as a slowdown, it's just that local conditions are affecting what exactly is happening.
Yeah.
So, Jazzy, you've made a video about this thing that's happening about LGBT videos on YouTube.
Maybe you should
explain to the people what's going on.
So since 2010, YouTube have had something called restricted mode, which has been marketed as something for families, public places, schools, as like a safe for work, essentially, version of YouTube that is going to block out anything that is controversial in any way, shape or form.
So sex, violence, that sort of thing.
Yeah, all of the good stuff. it turned out at the end of last week that a load of LGBT content that shouldn't have been blocked under those kinds of guidelines was indeed being blocked. There was a huge amount of concern about this because of the way that, like the fact that YouTube is used as a resource by a lot of queer kids who are perhaps isolated, are turning to YouTube as for want of a better word, role models for
advice,
validation,
and solidarity.
Advice. Yeah, exactly. For their own community, for their own tribe. And the fact that that was going to be taken away from those who are potentially the most vulnerable in that situation, those who are isolated, might not have a an internet connection that they themselves can have affordance over. That is, and there was quite rightly an uproar. YouTube initially kind of responded with a bit of a throwaway tweet with at YouTube creators, which is an account that everybody follows, obviously, and has alerts turned on for, where they basically said, LGBT content isn't specifically being blocked. You're clearly just... you're having... Stop being hysterical, guys. It wasn't the best apology. And then it kind of... people continued to kick off. And
YouTube eventually did say, we'll do something about this.
Yeah, so it's very rarely that YouTube apologises and says, we got shit wrong. But in this case, they apologised and got shit wrong. People are still kind of in the... I'm going to continue to moan about this because it's in vogue kind of part of the process at the moment, which is kind of frustrating. There's a few YouTubers who are still making videos about, oh, I'm being blocked, and YouTube is being homophobic, and YouTube is not trying to be homophobic. YouTube has said that as an organisation that we're trying to fix this. In order to kind of like cement what kind of ideals the creators think should be fixed at the end of this, we started a petition that asks for specific actions on YouTube's part that would give them more information about what is actually being blocked in real time and give creators more information about what is being blocked in real time.
I've just got to say something because I know that time is quick for me. What really surprised me about this was just how similar this was in like right-wing spaces as well. So like you have all these right-wing YouTubers who are like, YouTube is blocking me because of my content, and like Twitter and stuff like that. And I think, I don't know, part of it I think might be, I don't want to say narcissistic because I know if the right-wing it definitely was. Maybe it's about transparency. Maybe it's about like, you know, when the idea that like YouTube is trying to be all things to all people. And it's a supposedly political neutral space that people can kind of make their own. But that comes with risks, and that risk comes with, like, you know, certain things that you do to kind of express your identity may be at odds with how other people view theirs. And, you know, you might view your identity in one way and they might view it in another. And it's a problem with like platforms that are trying to be all things to all people. And this is going to continue happening. And I mean, like, YouTube did well on this one, but what happens when, you know, they have like a massive uproar from, you know, religious communities, for example, like, or just groups that don't necessarily have the same amount of like support among progressives as, you know, standard organizations.
I mean, do you feel that YouTube actually has a real obligation to be politically neutral, whatever that means, or do you think there's a validity to blocking certain bits of content?
I think they should recognise that they're an editorial organisation. Like,
if they are going to be restricting content,
if you're
going to
be restricting content, the thing is, the call for restricting content is coming, right? Mainly right now, that's with terrorist groups and with like extremist. Like when you transition from terrorist to extremist group, when like extremist non-violent extremism becomes part of the issue and we're going into this whole free speech debate, then it becomes an editorial organisation. And it has every right to be an editorial organisation. But it also means that it has to be...
Yeah, it's their platform at the end of the day.
But it also means that they have to be braver in terms of like actually admitting that, yes, we are an editorial platform.
But one of the problems is that YouTube has overwhelming dominance of video content on the internet. So if it decides to take an editorial stance, that will prove to be quite difficult.
Yeah, I don't upload anything to Dailymotion. like at all.
Yeah. or Vimeo.
Vimeo. Yeah.
Vimeo.
I mean, otherwise you have these things like these new sites like Gab. Mm-hmm. Which is like the alternative of Twitter, which is where all like the right wing people go, and maybe that's going to be like what the future of the internet's going to be.
Where Milo Yiannopoulos is now.
Yeah, it's probably.
All fun times.
All the Breitbart lot. Maybe that's what's going to be the internet's going to be now. I went to a conference the other day about people in color working in tech, and one of the things that was coming out was that we need to build our own platforms because YouTube is going to like crack down on movements like Black Lives Matter and stuff like that. You know, and. Yeah, that could happen, and you could have like lots of interesting creative sites where like different communities form. Mm-hmm. But then what you'll end up having is this very polarized internet space where
there's going to be even more
where the filter bubble like becomes the de facto thing, right? Mm-hmm. And we have to kind of ask ourselves the question of like, do we want an internet that's free and open to new ideas? And I think that's there's a certain egalitarian principle to that. Maybe people don't actually want that. Maybe they just want to go on the internet and like see the things that they want to see and be happy.
Yeah.
And maybe the future of the web is going to be that. It's going to be this place where like the things that you want to hear that will make you get through your day.
Mm-hmm. So will be readily available. Una King, who's the head of diversity at YouTube, and I'll be very clear. Yeah. You have to run off. She has said in the past that she wants YouTube to be a space where she can let her 6-year-old daughter roam free and not be scared about the kind of stuff that she's going to see. This has clearly been set up in a way to be able to realise that. But there's been whispers of the fact that this is a machine algorithm that has been set up, and we know from the Microsoft bot on Twitter that algorithms are not innately neutral, and if they are going to have human inputs, like what people are flagging, like what people are liking or complaining about, then it's going to maybe end up being a little bit racist and homophobic. Should we wrap up?
We should. Hussein, if people want to find you on the internet, where's the best place
to
do
that?
So
my Twitter account is @hkesvani. You can also email me at gkesvani@gmail.com.
Oh, nobody's given their email before. That's really exciting.
I like receiving emails, but tweet me memes, tweet me like stupid stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always fun with that. Or you can just like read my work on Vice when the next time I write, which I think is like next week.
Okay. And if you want to find us, I'm @JDENichols on Twitter. Jazza John is @JazzaJohn on Twitter. And
correct.
The podcast is @RightDishonor.
Please do tell us how much you hate us. We love you regardless. Right, toodaloo everyone. It's the outro with some person engagement. Da.
What did you just say?
Person engagement.
Person engagement. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's fine.
Yeah, we're going to flog this to death.
Yeah.
Until it happens.
This is the section where we now read out reviews and Jazza reacts to them live.
You have to put live in the title. Otherwise,
live.
Yeah, no, it's very exciting. Otherwise, people don't click on it. At least that's what it's like on YouTube. I'm not sure how it works when you stick something at the end of a podcast.
Indeed. So this is from Scoronadian. I'm assuming that I'm pronouncing that correctly.
I'm going to really enjoy you pronouncing.
Okay, look at that. How is that supposed to be pronounced?
Scoronadian.
Yeah, there you go. That's the only way to pronounce it. He's tweeted us. He says he can't leave a review on iTunes. Not sure I believe that, but...
I mean, yeah.
Okay.
We want to see the page that it fails at.
Yes, so mm-hmm. Send us some screenshot evidence.
Yeah, otherwise we won't believe you.
Entertaining podcast, mainly opinions on things that are happening in politics. I like that.
I mean, it's correct.
Yeah, I mean, you just go downhill from here.
Oh, no.
Hosts need to research topics a bit better. Audio quality is not great.
We have a very expensive microphone, I have you know.
I'm a little bit hurt by that, because our audio quality used to be very shit.
And now it's brilliant.
Passable.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, brilliant, passable.
Now it's like, okay. It will probably be able to be used as a bit of B-roll for Radio 4.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, moving on. This is Nikki Daly again. I'm assuming that I'm pronouncing your surname correctly.
How is it written? Come here. Daly.
I said Daly or Dally?
Dally, Daly.
Who
Delay.
we actually read out a review from last time, and she tells us...
I mean, if she's the only one that's going to leave reviews, then we'll continue to just give her a lot of the attention.
Leave us a review every week. Yeah. We'll probably read it out. Yeah. The other half is a Corbinite and tends to get very shouty and cross when I put this on in the house, which amuses me greatly. Sinister, I think.
Can be used as ammunition against Corbinites.
Some sort of torture weapon.
I like that we're making marriages, or at least partnerships, less stable.
Yes, that is one of our aims.
Purely by existing.
And this is, no offence to the other reviews, but this is probably like the best engagement we've had. The ladies from the DAS podcast, who we had on a couple of weeks back.
Oh yeah, they're brilliant.
They've sent us some lovely mugs.
Mm-hmm, they have. You can go on to twitter.com/rightdishonour, and you can see the mugs. And it's made us think that we should have merch.
Yeah, we felt, we're like, we don't have our own merch.
No.
We're behind the curve.
And I still think that we have a brilliant logo that would work very well on mug.
Yeah, I mean, their logo is very effective on the mug.
It's very stylish. It's very cool.
And on the back it says, you can never betray the sisterhood.
Mm-hmm. So. Which Jimmy enjoys being incorporated into.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, that's good. I have one more.
Oh, you have one more. And very exciting.
Jess is going to read out an iTunes review.
Yeah, I worry that we've gone too full out with this and there's going to be nothing left for next week.
Yeah. That might happen, but let's carry on.
That's fine.
Neek. That is what it says.
Neek. Yeah, Dominique. N-I-Q-U-E. Yeah.
And he says, recently started listening to Right Dishonor. How did I not know about this earlier? Highly recommend it. So,
we are highly recommended. So our audio quality is shit. We piss off the Corbinites, but are also good.
Highly recommended, so thank you for that.
All right, I'll give you the iTunes one now, seeing as that you've mentioned it.
This is somewhat in more depth than the other tweets.
Yeah, so this is from MZ, and she says... I'm assuming that she says, because it's a name that ends in IE. The two hosts, Jazz and Jimmy, present the week's political news and discuss it in a balanced way. That's not true.
It's relatively balanced.
Yeah.
If you compare it to like, well, she goes, on the Spectator or something.
She goes on to say, however, so although the political leanings of the hosts are obvious, they are very different, so are able to present the show in a very balanced way. May I remind you, MZ, that me and Jimmy used to both be members of the Liberal Democrats, and so we only really disagree on... You know, Brexit being shit.
I don't want to pump us up too much, but I feel that you listen to some other podcasts and the level of groupthink is...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they just say yes.
Yeah.
Whereas Jimmy is very happy to troll me.
Troll Jazza.
Their coverage of Brexit was one of the best that I've found. As a Remainer, Jimmy does a very good job. Jimmy is not a Remainer.
No, she's saying I found as a Remainer.
Oh, so as a Remainer... Jimmy does a very good job of making the future seem less bleak with his optimistic view of Brexit. While Jazza helps by venting exactly what I'm thinking, I'm happy to be the conduit to your grief, listener. Please leave us more reviews because we really enjoy doing these. It's really fun. Even to be told that our audio is shit, it's not shit. How dare you?
We're very offended by that.
We'll talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.